back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today, we also have Michael Snydell.
Hello!
And a special guest with us today to talk about the Meyerowitz stories, new and selected, is director Stephen Cohn.
Hello.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thank you for joining us. This is quite a treat because you have a film that is coming out this week.
I do.
Would you like to give a light plug for that?
Yeah, for sure. It's called Princess Cid. We've been out on the festival circuit since May, and we open in New York and Chicago this Friday the 3rd and Los Angeles on December 1st. We'll leave it at that for now because I want people to come to the theater. So
yes. It played at the Maryland Film Festival, my home state's film festival.
Yeah, it had its world premiere. It was my second feature in a row to have world premiere at Maryland.
Whoa.
So Henry Gamble and Cid both world premiered there, and then they both traveled on to BAM Cinema Fest, and then both of them traveled on to Frameline. So I've had kind of the first kind of triple header for both films, and so those festivals have been real champs and that, you know, they've been sort of ideal launches actually, just in terms of like staying power and the sort of like slow burn word of mouth that actually is kind of preferable to other types of word of mouth. I love Maryland.
That is awesome. My little crazy little mid-Atlantic state slowly making its way up in the world. We're not reviewing your movie today, but I will say that I have seen it and it is wonderful. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And don't be scared, but we might actually review it on this show because there's a lot that I want to talk about in it. And,
yeah, I agree.
No, feel free.
It's great.
Excellent. We will make sure to tag you on Twitter when that happens so you can listen to us. Spend.
Or bring you back on.
Nope. It's going to be the podcast version of talking behind someone's back.
Okay.
But yes, we are here today to talk about the Meyerowitz stories, new and selected. I'm going to stop saying new and selected after this point. By writer-director Noah Baumbach. And it stars Adam Sandler. Surprise, surprise. Also, Dustin Hoffman. Judd Hirsch is in there as well. I'm gonna leave it at that for now. We'll get into everyone else later. Before we do, let me remind everyone who's listening at home to follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. Go to Patreon and help us to continue to put on this show by becoming a patron at the low, low cost of $1 per episode. You will gain access to our Slack channel, be entered into all of our raffles, and generally have a sense of wellness and achievement that can only come with giving us $1 every episode by going to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. And of course, we are brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. Every day, Mubi introduces a new film and you have 30 days to watch, so you always have 30 great films on rotation for you to select from. You can download them to your mobile devices to watch them on the go, or you can watch them on your computer or your smart TV. And Mubi has a great selection. They're doing some of their kooky, scary stuff right now with all the Halloween goodness coming at you. And they're also doing a Takashi Miike retrospective, which I don't know about you guys, but that sounds also Halloween-y to me as well. So Mubi. All you got to do for your free 30-day trial of Mubi is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you can have a free 30-day trial to the goodness that is Mubi. Again, that is mubi.com/filmstage. And now the time has come to get into the main event. That is the Meyerowitz Stories, the newest film from writer-director Noah Baumbach. It stars Adam Sandler, Ben Stiller, Dustin Hoffman, Elizabeth Marvel, Emma Thompson. Judd Hirsch is in there. There is a cameo that I'm not sure I want to give away just yet, but it's kind of awesome. And here is the trailer.
The owner of this place is a client. That's why we could get a table so last minute. That's why they gave us this bigger table. I imagine they'll send some complimentary stuff too.
$55 for a steak?
They're known for their meat here.
And $35 for a salmon? You get the salmon to blow you for that price?
Are you Harold Meyerowitz's son, Matthew?
Yes. And this is Danny, also Harold Meyerowitz's son.
I didn't realize he had two sons.
And a daughter.
Dad, it'll be okay here.
It'll be nice to spend time with Dad. You know, I didn't get a lot of time with him growing up.
Son of a bitch! Well, once we had an easy
ride, and always felt the same. Dad, what the fuck? Was on my side, and I had everything
to gain. Really, they take all of the
All right, so that is part of the trailer for the Meyerowitz stories. New and selected, breaking my promise to myself. And, this movie is a series of vignettes and short stories that center around the Meyerowitz family, specifically the relationship of the children to the patriarch, Harold Meyerowitz, who is a formerly celebrated sculptor. I think that's the best way to put it. Let's talk about it. Let's see what we all thought. Before we really get into our primary thoughts on this movie, I'd love for us to go around and just talk about what our feelings are on Noah Baumbach in general. So, Stephen, you are our guest. Why don't we start with you? Before we began, you had said that you were a bit of a Baumbach agnostic. So, why don't you expand on that for us?
Yeah, what was the one from the early one, Kicking and Screaming? Is that what it's called?
Yes.
The one from the movies. So I mean, I have to say, I don't entirely remember my feelings about that, although I do remember being like, okay, that was fine. And then, Squid and the Whale, I don't want to be long-winded about it, but Squid and the Whale, I found kind of a, I know it was supposed to be unpleasant, but I had just a really unpleasant experience watching that film, and not in the way that not in a wonderfully unpleasant way. It was like I feel gross. I don't know if I like this. And then Greenberg felt ambiguous about, even though it had some lovely moments. There are moments through all these movies that are really special, I think, but I've never loved the work. I just haven't. It hasn't been my thing. It's a particular kind of metro cynicism or whatever that I is totally valid, but I just haven't found I don't feel at home there. So same for Margaret at the Wedding and the others. But, when I first saw this last week, this new one, I just kind of felt like this was the first one I'd really loved. I actually really, really loved the film. And I don't quite know why. I know on the surface it resembles the others, but there's something that's happened to him as an artist over the last, I don't know, couple of years that I think is really interesting. And something's opening up. I'm not saying I only like movies when the cynics open their hearts, but there is something happening there that's like, I think really touching, and this movie extends outward in a way that I think his other films don't. His other films look inside; they're very internal gazing. There's something about this movie that's just more generous. It's more open. It's more. I don't know. So I really love it, but I haven't quite nailed down exactly what it is that touched me so much. I just there's something as Noah Baumbach is aging, perhaps. And experimenting and meeting new people and seeing movies and talking about movies on panels. There's something that seems to be shifting in a really exciting way.
All right. Michael Snydell, what are your thoughts on Noah Baumbach?
Yeah, I also, like Steve and I run a little bit hot and cold on Baumbach. Like he's someone to borrow Steven's word again of unpleasant. He's definitely someone who's abrasive, it's abrasive screwball dialogue that's admirable, but also not in a way that I expect from screwball. You look at someone like Whit Stillman or, even classic screwball, Preston Sturgis, that's something that's, so entertaining in its rapid fire, way, but him, it sucks the air out of the room and everybody's always climbing on top of each other in a conversation. And it gets a little bit much. The one I really did like was Mistress America, in part because I thought Lola Kirk was really good at portraying kind of this like teenage uncertainty. But even if I don't necessarily like his films that much, he's always a director who I think is finding kind of new shades to kind of like New York narcissism and self-involvement. And so there were things I liked in this, and I definitely think that it's like as far as filmmaking, it seems to be to have a much bigger scope than some of his other films, in the sense of just like how conversations move and stuff. So just on that level, it's enjoyable to me, but sometimes I just really want the characters to just like slow down, just engage with each other instead of talking past each other.
All right. Bill Graham, what about yourself?
So I'm one of the few people that I guess didn't get around to seeing The Squid and the Whale. I haven't followed Bob Ack's career from kind of my point was Greenberg, and I really didn't like Greenberg that much. I think that's one of his more kind of abrasive films, and Ben Stiller in that in particular is just like grating. I saw Frances Ha, and then I saw Mistress America, and then obviously I've seen Meyerowitz stories. So his stock has just risen and risen. And you know, it's funny. I'm looking here, and I guess he co-wrote some of my favorite films. Fantastic Mr. Fox. He actually co-wrote with Wes Anderson. So that's definitely one that he's in the tank for me for that. So I guess I'm going to have to start paying more attention to him going forward. Infamously, maybe famously, I don't know. He's kind of sworn off Netflix because of at least Ryan, I know you probably would, you know, gladly agree with, just simply because they haven't really kind of unfolded it the way I guess maybe they might have promised him, even though it is still Netflix and they still are going to release it on like, you know, 15 cities nationwide, but it's going to be in like very select cities, and most of them are going to be at IPIC theaters and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see where this kind of film goes forward for him, whether he continues the relationship with Netflix or not. But I'm just delighted that it's on this big of a platform for a lot of people to kind of indulge in.
So for me, I had a breakup with Noah Baumbach. Longtime fans of the show will recall the episode on Frances Ha, where I gained many enemies by saying that it was the most frustrating, unpleasant, pointless, worthless waste of my life that I had experienced up until then.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, right. It then later got shafted by Kate Plays Christine, which took that title, I guess.
Oh, boy.
I can't even thinking back now, I don't remember what it was about Frances Ha that truly, truly destroyed me in that way, but it did. And I didn't bother seeing anything else that he had made. Missed Mistress America, missed While We're Young, and anything else that he's made since then. And I just, you know, like, I'd really loved Greenberg. I don't know why, but that movie, like, reached me on many levels. I don't know. It was one of my favorite films of that year. And then, you know, I saw Frances Ha, and I was just like, maybe there's something about someone who just keeps looking at the same types of people that really kind of bums me out, because it feels like, you know, playing the same notes in a different order, not really like picking up any new instruments or anything. So it was with some trepidation that I agreed to talk about the Meyerowitz stories, to the point that Jordan actually got in touch with me on Slack today and said, did you hate the Meyerowitz stories as much as you hated Frances Ha? Because I'd hate for us to have a guest on the show just for you to have another nuclear meltdown. Because as my two constant co-hosts can probably attest, I could be hard to handle when that happens.
No.
I feel like I'm I don't know you, Brian, but I know you better quicker than I expected. So no, we're good. I get you. I get okay. it. I get what's going on here. Although I would say, I mean, I think I don't mean this in a condescending way, but I think that the Baumbach Gerwig stuff is almost a separate category. Like it's mm-hmm. almost a separate genre because yeah. of what she brings to the movie. So it's almost hard to speak of Frances Ha and Mistress America in the same discussion as Squid and the Whale, Margot at the Wedding, and Greenberg, because those are such a – or she's in Greenberg. I don't think she co-wrote Greenberg, but maybe that's The Bridge, that movie.
Yeah, and that's – I mean, that's a solid point, and it's something that other people have said. And now, having seen the Meyerowitz stories, I definitely agree with that, because this movie, I guess spoiler for my opinion, I quite enjoyed. I really liked it. And it's funny because the people here are at times a lot more horrible than Frances Ha ever was. And I don't know why I liked them more and wanted to spend this much time with them more than I wanted to spend with her. I don't know if it's because there's a critical distance or they're kind of open understanding of their own flaws and foibles was a little more self-aware than Frances's. But for whatever reason, I found myself quite smitten with the Meyerowitz stories. And, there's something, though, about, like, it being on Netflix that, again, just kind of, like, I hate to say this, but it felt cheap to me. And there were times when I wasn't sure if it was, like, my connection or something, but some parts of it aesthetically looked really rough. And I don't know if you all saw it in theater or on Netflix, but
that was shot on 16, right? Is it shot on 16mm?
That is my belief.
Yeah.
I will look that up. I think that just like, you know, getting it streamed over Netflix, even if it's at 1080p, it's just still not gonna look quite right.
I mean, I think the one thing that should be said is there is like a weird lo-fi quality to this movie that I don't really think the other Baumbachs have in terms of like camera work. Like there is just a sense of like less is more, but also like a messiness. Like it's kind of I feel like it's a weirder visual style than most of the past Baumbach films. Granted, it's been a while since I've watched some of them, but I don't know if it's, I'm not disagreeing with you about the Netflix thing, but I do think that some of the camera work in here is just odd and meant to feel like it's, you know, pushing against the medium.
Especially out in public. Like whenever they were shooting in a public space, part of me yeah. got like this feeling like, are they doing this guerrilla style? And that's yeah. in a good way. I liked that.
Yeah.
I liked the kind of naturalism of it. The only other thing I'll say is that, you know, just as because Bill brought up it being on Netflix and because we've talked about Netflix in the past, I mean, it was impossible to find. And I don't know if sharing a Netflix account with like three nameless people who I can't remember who I gave my login information to plus a baby has anything to do with that. But like Netflix did not want to give me this movie.
No, I think that's true for everybody. I don't think they put it on the front page.
Yeah. Why do it then? I don't get it, but I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah.
I'm not going to derail us that much, but let's see what everyone else thought about the Meyerowitz stories since paradoxically I gave my opinion first. Steven, why don't you kick us off and give us a little more in-depth view into what you thought of this movie?
Oh, I was kind of just going to respond.
Real quick.
It
is shot on Super 16.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Mm. I mean, just responding to a couple of points that have been brought up. I mean, for me, what's weird about seeing it on Netflix is just the fact that I can watch a brand new Noah Baumbach movie on Netflix, and that felt very weird from beginning to end. It felt weird that I was watching it. I felt like I was in the future. And so like not even, you know, not in a positive or negative way. It was just like, this is so weird. I'm watching a new release in my house. And then, so that was strange to me. But yeah, I mean, you could do 17 podcasts about just Netflix pros and cons, all that stuff. But, I will say, yeah, I mean, the 16mm thing and the sort of messiness, I think, is directly connected to what I felt was really liberating about the film. I think he's, in some ways, I don't know. I'm a walking contradiction, so I'm going to contradict myself a lot. But in some ways, it felt like the prototypical Noah Baumbach movie. In other ways, it felt like he stopped caring about being Noah Baumbach and just wanted to go crazy and be free. Almost. So there's an urgency to the film that I think, Brian, that may be what you're responding to, is this sort of wildness that wasn't there in the previous movies. He's almost like he was so aware of his inspirations and the kind of movie he was trying to make. That those movies maybe felt a little shut in or closed in or something. I don't know. I mean, even Mistress America, which has this really ebullient, joyful heart and soul and is really entertaining, still feels like someone who's aware of the kind of genre that they're inhabiting. And there's just something about Meyerowitz where he just doesn't seem to be all that self-conscious. And yeah, I think it's really wild, literally wild. There were moments when I was like, I can't believe I like this. This feels almost like an SNL parody of a Noah Baumbach movie. And then 2 seconds later, something would happen that would just be a shocking epiphany of human interaction that I haven't seen in a movie in years. And so it's this weird contradiction of like, it's like, who, these are actors, these are movie stars playing like neurotic New Yorkers. This is all fabricated and surface, and yet it also functions for me as a really insightful, evocative, kind of heartbreaking movie. So there's two, it's operating in two modes, and I just find it kind of a fascinating object. But I just, for example, like the relationship, I feel like people are always like, oh, the father-daughter relationship is so well drawn. And, you know, we've heard that before in other movies. It's like, oh, it's like, I've never seen a relationship like this adult and this young person. Like, and in this movie, that's true. But also there is something so lovely about that relationship that I don't think Baumbach could have done 5 to 10 years ago. And again, I just go back to where he seems to be in some kind of new, free space. But, you know, I think I tweeted something like Meyerowitz Stories is 900 epiphanies laid out in a row. And I felt that watching it, where it was just like one surprising moment after another. And maybe some of them seemed surface or showy, but mostly to me, I was like, there's some kind of weird magic going on here. So I'm probably overrating it, to be honest. But I'm excited. I liked it so much, and so at least now I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's your opinion. It's you know, that you're explicating. It's hard to say that you're overrating it when it's we're couching this very clearly in the fact that these are our opinions. But yeah, I mean, I have to agree with just about everything that you said. I think that even though I agree, I'm not overrating it. I feel like I'm still cooler on it than you are, while somehow still agreeing with everything that you're saying. So that's one for the message boards. Figure that out. But Michael Snydell, what did you think of the Meyerowitz Stories?
Yeah, I like it. Steven, you're kind of making me like it more now, too. The parts that I responded to the most were honestly the things that did feel a little bit off to me. You know, even thinking about the structure where Brian already mentioned it's, you know, kind of like an anthology of vignettes, but there's something kind of really interesting in the way that it's like it editorializes itself in a way that is both kind of a parody of like, you know, like almost like Roth or Philip Roth, but also it seems to be very aware to not like marginalize its own characters. Like I think specifically of someone like Gene, who is like consciously in the margins, but the movie never forgets. Like it's really interesting to have these characters and interactions that are at once like revelations and nothing at all. And I think that's when the movie is the most interesting, and in how weirdly it moves from these times where I'm like, man, I am really irritated with these characters, to where they say something, you know, really smart or interesting, or, you know, like just the way that antagonism gives away to like that begrudging like family relationship. And that stuff is really interesting. I guess some of the stuff I want to get to more in spoilers, but the last thing I want to say is this also really gets across how frustrating it is. This is the second movie after Big Sick that gets across how frustrating it is dealing with doctors at a hospital and trying to understand what to do and just the weird sense where you are totally involved with something, but other people just have a thousand things going on. And it's not like they don't care, but like life moves on. And I guess that could be the theme of the whole movie, honestly. But just the way that it portrays that, I think, is really on point. Even if I think some of the more literary aspects are just a little bit too overwritten, and I get that's kind of the point, but at some point I think I did want just like weirdly a bit more self-consciousness, or even like a bit more articulation of maybe even, you know, of this like rapid fire dialogue also meeting narration for instance, or something along those lines that just pushes a little bit, because I guess I don't know how to take some of this stuff, whether it is supposed to be taken at face value or whether, you know, there is a little bit of that, parody. I think that's that middle ground is where I don't know what to do with this film.
It's interesting that you brought up the concept of like parody, because that's a lot of these films like this, you know, intellectual New York upper class, sure, you know, white, possibly neurotic and Jewish, but doesn't have to be. Like, I'm thinking specifically of Listen Up, Philip.
Still haven't watched it.
another movie that I'm sort of famous for disliking. And like everything in that with Jason Schwartzman and Jonathan Pryce felt like a parody. And so I was nervous, coming with Dustin Hoffman in this as, Harold Meyerowitz, who is a once respected sculptor who now kind of gets overlooked even at retrospectives of his contemporaries. But I was like, I was shocked at how much like humanity and truth and like mm-hmm. reality there was, because he's just a man who did a job and he would like to have that recognized, and he wasn't so far up his own ass that he became a parody of himself. And a lot of the issues that he had with his family stemmed not specifically from his artistry, but more or less from just the same problems that every family has, where it's like, I wish you would have gone into my line of work, whatever X might be. And then sure. kind of ignoring the children who are expressing themselves in that line of work just because of the one who didn't, that somehow grates at you more.
What's like the difference between the characters being pretentious and the movie being pretentious?
Yes, absolutely. Bill Graham, what about you? What did you think of the Meyerowitz stories?
I really enjoyed this movie from beginning to end. I think the fact that it is broken up into the narrative design that it is, and I guess I don't know if we've specifically mentioned it to this point, but you know, it is kind of broken up into almost vignettes in a way. I think it's got four parts, if I'm not mistaken. The first part, we are introduced to Adam Sandler's character, and the second part we're introduced to Ben Stiller's, and the we get a little bit of some of the children and kind of moves around from there. And I think
leaving out Gene.
Well, I mean, is Gene – I don't think – oh, that's right. Gene does have her own little section, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. In parentheses. A very important, very meaningful section. So yes, that is funny, because that's kind of – her arc in the movie is like yes. the one who gets left out.
Sure. Yes. Her opinion is not always sought and everything like that. She's got a great role. I've seen her in a few things here and there, but she's definitely a standout in this, I think, in this particular film. And I do want to say, I think the way that that's kind of broken up narratively is really smart and really interesting. And I think it gives it kind of a fresh style. I'm not sure how much he, filmed it with that narrative arc kind of involved. I'm sure that was in the scripting process and everything like that. But I'm not sure what kind of energy he had on set and, you know, whether it felt like it was vignettes or whether it was just kind of all shot out of order like a lot of these things are and then just slowly pieced together. Either way, I think it's interesting because this film really plays off of those kind of family dynamics where it's interesting because they all know each other a little bit, but they all are not super involved in each other's lives. This reminds me a lot of if your like very close family were so far away that you only saw them, you know, once or twice a year. And otherwise, you didn't really keep track of them and keep in touch with them. This is like a long extended like Thanksgiving dinner where it's just like ongoing with people that you kind of know, but you're kind of like, yeah, but I don't really. And so as soon as you see them, you just want to catch up. And so I think the dynamics there, having to handle and deal with their father all at the same time, is very interesting because they're learning how to not only deal with that headache, but also how to communicate with each other. And oh, by the way, I'm communicating with you and you're also communicating with my daughter, who I don't really communicate with. And you're giving me insight into my daughter's life that I'm not even aware of, you know? So it's a lot of interesting kind of, I think Mike mentioned it early on, how they kind of talk past each other. And I really enjoyed it in this particular film because I think a lot of the narcissism of these characters is kind of fleshed out in that way where they just have their own opinion. And Adam Sandler is, you know, in particular, one that does this a lot throughout the film where he just consistently thinks that he knows the answer to the question that he's asking Ben Stiller. And yet Ben Stiller is constantly like, no, that's not quite it. That's not quite it. That's not quite it. That's not quite it. So I really enjoyed the flow of the dialogue in this film, the settings and particularly the characters, as grating and as annoying as they can be. I think it's entertaining to spend time with them just simply because you hope they get along and you just wish the best for them. I think there's something inherently good about a lot of these characters that you just feel for. And so therefore you're rooting for them despite the fact that like they're just kind of assholes at times. Beyond that, I don't have too much more to say. I'm interested to kind of talk with y'all about this. So,
yeah, it's funny that you say that they're all good characters because this is a film, you know, lacking a protagonist or not a protagonist. It's lacking an antagonist. There's not really an enemy to be defeated. And so like the enemy shifts from story to story. The enemy could be the lack of good parking, in Greenwich Village. The enemy could be this asshole who keeps putting his stuff on your table. Yes. And then the enemy could be the way that your father reacts to the asshole putting the stuff on your table. And it's nice how like things escalate and mutate and mature as they go along. And the only time that the movie really felt false to me was in the hospital, oddly enough. Not so much the way they keep getting shuffled around and people keep changing, but like the amount of stuff that they are given to help them through what is happening is contrary to every like final visit to a hospital that I've ever been through. And ooh. I don't know why that bothered me so much in the movie. It kind of felt like the like the pre-grief counselor and everything was just a way to kind of shoehorn a beat in that could be delivered on later. But yeah, I don't know. Does anyone else does anyone else have that kind of experience? And B, does anyone else like feel that way, that there were just certain things that kind of slightly broke the reality? Because like there are things like his coat going missing and then him finding a ticket stub and having this weird aside about the fault in our stars that could very easily feel overwritten but actually felt very true. But then for me there was just that moment in the hospital and I was like, this feels a little too set up, this feels a little too, you know, part one, and I just gotta wait for part two to deliver the meaning.
I had a ton of, I mean, thankfully a ton of hospital experiences actually, but I have heard other people who've had the opposite reaction to the film, that they felt like it got it exactly right. So I wonder if it's, I don't know if it's, maybe it's particular to particular kind of hospital or region or something, but I there were some New Yorkers, I think, who identified very strongly with that hospital sequence. I love the hospital sequence. But I would need to go back and watch it to see those exact moments that pulled you out. Maybe, you know, I'm sure you have a point. Not that the only thing that pulled me out, and maybe this is because I make films and also teach at Northwestern, is I thought they were hilarious.
Oh, man.
I thought they were hilarious, but in a movie that's like, that seemed to mostly want to err on the side of like, actual, it's okay. I mean, I would have been fine if they were tacky and funny and stupid. That's not the problem. It's that, oh, I can see the filmmakers having a little too much fun here. You know, it's not like, it's not 100% evoking what this girl's project would actually look or feel like. You know, it might be similar. It might have a similar vibe. It might be even worse in quality. But there was something particularly kind of satirical about that bit. But you know what? I mean, Noah Baumbach's a really smart guy, and he may have done that deliberately and said, this is our moment to kind of take a jab at this sort of thing. But those were the moments where I was like, oh, come on. And then I thought the decision to I guess the nudity, the nudity of the girl took me out a little bit. And I'd say this is someone who's currently working on prepping a feature about a nude photographer. So nudity doesn't bother me at all, but I thought it was just one of those things of like, okay, Noah Baumbach took the youngest, most beautiful person in this movie and found an opportunity for them to be naked in some way. I'm sort of ambivalent about that, but anyway, I'm saying a lot of things, but those are the things that kind of took me out. And then I thought honestly, something that took me out at first and then I thought was actually quite beautiful was the twist of the sexual trauma in Jean's past.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that first felt very, we're not doing spoilers yet, are we?
Yeah.
I mean, we can. I don't have a problem with it. It's hard in this movie to say what's a spoiler and what's not, sure. Because like, yeah, there are things that happen that you might care whether or not Harold makes it or what happens with his house. But sure. I mean, this is a lot more gray area because, you know, we're not wondering if Spider-Man wins at the end. Sure. We're just kind of following these people and enjoying their lives. So I'll say, from this moment on, we can freely talk about the plot. I think we've made our feelings on it pretty clear. Everyone's got the opportunity to go out and see this. Well, stay in and see this. So, yeah, let's dive in more.
Sure. No, I think, Steven, I just wanted to say briefly before we get past the student film thing. The student film thing was, like, ridiculous to me, but I think I was also just pleasantly surprised that he wasn't as sour as he was in While We're Young, because he seemed to just despise Adam Driver's character and Amanda Seyfried's character.
Oh,
like,
I agree.
Contempt he showed for them. I was just glad, even if it was really unnecessary, I was glad that he seemed to be in on the joke.
Oh no, I need to make myself clear. I enjoyed the hell out of those bits, but if there was anything that sort of like put me at a remove or just it reminded me that it was, you know, that I was watching a movie, that was definitely something.
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't even know how to feel about those student films. It's like,
yeah, they are something else, aren't they?
I understand what you're saying. Like, yeah. it's a little weird that like they did take like the youngest, most attractive person, sure. But even beyond that, like it felt like it feels like the thing that someone who's trying to be transgressive and confrontational would do first. Like,
yeah,
it's like my first semester in college. What can I do? I'm going to get naked in front of the camera. And, it was just, I think that Adam Sandler, his reaction to it was like perfect. Like, he's just like, well, I'm going to finish watching that alone because I don't need the rest of the family seeing this. And then, was it Gene?
But also the pride.
Yeah. Was it Gene who said like, that was really R-rated?
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. And then of course she ends up starring him in the next short film. Yeah. Next six. Yeah. 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 So
I mean, I'm currently sort of making the case for it in my mind. I mean, it's worth saying, yes, it's fun for them to have done, but it is worth saying that it does connect and create a little arc in terms of like how she comes to appreciate her grandfather's work. And so there is something to be said for sort of experiencing her art and then seeing her in those final moments sort of kind of movingly create a link in history, you know, to sort of like to complete the circle a little bit, or to and to the artistic impulses that have been passed on. So it maybe it's more of a part of the story and has a is more connective tissue than I'm making it out to be.
And so we decided we were gonna get into spoilers, so let's talk, speaking about Jean and her place in the film and the films. What were you gonna say about her story having to do with her her trauma. Experience.
Oh, the experience with the old guy. Yeah. Well, I was going to put it in the list of things that took me out, but it's not really. I mean, it's something that I thought was going to take me out and that took me out for like 3 or 4 minutes and then kind of seemed to be all of a piece. I thought it was a really, I could see how people could perceive it as a kind of, a kind of morally dubious, you know, it takes in the final third of your movie to just toss in sexual molestation or abuse. And so it's jarring by nature, whether it works or not. And it didn't feel like it was working. And then just something about the sort of pulling back when the movie's over and feeling the sense of the movie as a whole where that felt all of a piece. And in some way she it's one of the points of the story that she gets nudged to the side, you know, and she
sure
in a sense is sort of kind of the secret weapon of the movie and of this family. And so it actually makes narrative sense that it would just be like flippantly tossed out towards the end. I don't know what I'm saying other than it was one of those choices that in the hands of another maybe younger or less experienced filmmaker could have been a deeply, deeply offensive, wrongheaded move, but that he somehow brings home.
Well, in particular, because of the timing of this, you know, we live in the wake of the Weinstein situation and everything like that. This premiered at Cannes in May. So, you know, obviously Baumbach didn't have any clue that this is something that was going to actually happen. But just the same, I think it's interesting that they do kind of pull it together. And what they do with that in particular is Adam Sandler and Ben Stiller's character decide to enact retribution and like just murder this guy's car. And she sees the car and she's like, why the fuck would you do that? Like, and in a lot of ways that is the film kind of encapsulated, is they take all this action and they take all this bluster and they do all these things out loud. And she's the one kind of sitting in the back just going like, no, don't do that. Like,
yeah, they even ask her after she tells the story and she mentions that she brought it up to their father. And he said, well, did he touch you? Like, did anything like that happen? And she said, no. And he's like, okay, well, then you know, I don't really know what to do about this. Let's just
let's just pretend it didn't happen.
And so
and get through the weekend, like, because so, he was visiting or something.
Yeah. And so it's interesting because like that it is in its own way, without the whole movie being about it, like this very interesting encapsulation of the type of stuff that we are seeing nowadays getting dragged into the sunlight. And her, and then they ask her, like, Jesus Christ, like, why do you even like come around? Like, what are you still doing being here? And she's like, well, I like you guys. I like hanging out with you, which is crazy because how is that even possible? Like somehow, in spite of that, what in, as you were saying, a lesser movie written by a lesser filmmaker would be like a crippling, debilitating thing. She's fine and she's less fucked up than they are just because like their dad didn't treat them right. And yet she still says like you trashed that man's car, but I'm still all fucked up in just like the perfect encapsulation of like, you know, these guys who want to like rush to the defense of their wronged sister, but like can't even begin to consider how to do it the correct way.
Or even ask her like, you know,
yeah,
I mean, they're like, do you want to join in? And she's like, no. And they're just kind of defeated by that because like they were elated by the fact that they did this to this old man's car.
It made them feel better, but it did not do anything for her.
Which, by the way, I do want to point out that there is the distinct, and you know, this is too much reality I'm bringing to this, but there is the distinct possibility that that was not actually that old man's car, but instead his helper's car. So, you know, it's one of those situations where it's like, you fucking assholes don't even know exactly if that is his car or not. Like,
that is a hilarious point.
Yeah.
Is also the second movie in a couple of weeks that we've talked about that has involved man versus car. And, I just gotta say,
watch that,
you know,
show.
Vince Vaughn, still the champion of beating up a car.
Sure. That is straight Street Fighter, like bonus round stuff that he does to that poor car.
And
this
these
is the Brawl movie you're referring to.
Yes, Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Yeah.
I think one other thing I want to mention about that scene as well, going back to what Steven is saying, is, you know, a less talented director may have tried to make that more of a moment. You know, they might have done a close up or something like that. And if I remember correctly, it stays in wide for nearly the whole time, even when they try to give her that hug and try to comfort her in that really half-assed way. Like, yeah. The whole thing is in a wide angle. There's no music. It is that, like, both her really robotic, like really fast delivery of her saying she's been abused, as well as the way the camera angle, and then going into this weird, you know, jaunt where they go break up the car, like it's that weird, like, even keeled tone and like visual language that makes that work and makes that and like still communicates everything. Like, that's, I guess, what coming away, what I'm so impressed with this movie is, it's at once like ostentatious at times, but also never gets in the way of any of the beats or, like, you know, what is emotionally honest.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
absolutely.
It's something that we see as I think sometimes as filmmakers get older, one of the wonderful things that happen is the work gets lighter and they're not taking themselves so seriously. If you've ever seen Noah Baumbach talk, he's a deeply serious person.
Yes.
And you know, if the squid and the whale lacks anything, it's any semblance of a sense of humor or lightness. I mean, it's one of the most serious. I mean, there are funny moments. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about kind of the worldview behind the thing. And so, you know, to me, that some of this lightness and just like the, let's just watch these people stumble towards some sort of grace. I mean, Baumbach will always be in the category of a Woody Allen or a Philip Roth, but this is him just edging ever so slightly away from those guys and towards people like Cassavetes and Renoir, who were in a little bit more of a sort of wild, celebratory, generous mode of work. Mm-hmm. And there is, at its best, this movie does remind me of, you know, Cassavetes at his silliest and most moving. So, you know, all of this, I think, is just a sign of maturity. It's also more fun to watch. I mean, how cool that,
sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How cool that, like, the richer things get, off, the more entertaining they get, too. Like,
well, go figure. And it's, I was going to say, like, what it kind of reminded me of every now and then was Manchester by the Sea. Not so much in the situation or... And like really almost anything about it, which invalidates my point. But for some reason, watching the two of them, I had a similar sense on like an impersonal level that they were kind of treading in like the same forest, but Manchester's was perhaps deeper and darker in the forest. Just like this idea of the fact that like tragedy and the things that bind us together, like even though that's happening, you're still the same person that you always are, which is something that a lot of movies and television shows and novels and really everything kind of fail at, is they will like leech a person of their humanity when the time comes for them to become a griever or someone who is having a fight with someone. And both Manchester and this movie like have the grace and the understanding to realize that like if you're the type of person who makes a shitty joke every now and then, even if someone's in the hospital, that part of you is still going to peek through now and then. And yeah. So there's a lot of truth and reality in that. So just in the same way that Manchester by the Sea had every hilarious moment in it between Casey Affleck and his nephew in the film, this movie had that between all of these people. And that's why you get something like people beating the shit out of a car, is because even though your father is laying in the hospital with sepsis, you're still going to need to get some kind of satisfaction and you're going to take control however you can. And it will manifest itself in the most juvenile way possible.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that movie because they share an editor.
Oh,
really?
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually was hoping I could bring her up. I think her name is Jet. Well, one of you has IMDb open, I'm sure.
Jennifer Lane.
Yeah, she's like she's a relatively young editor. She's edited most of Baumbach's movies from the last 6 or 7 years, and she also edited Manchester. I just think that's a really interesting. And if you notice, all of these movies do share a certain kind of atonal editing rhythm. I mean, there's something kind of thrusty and that, you know, the kind of jarring about how she works. And so I don't know, she's been on my radar for just the last few weeks. I was like, oh, what an interesting rhythm, what an interesting a lot of that, you know, who knows how much of those moments also come from that collaboration, which obviously is very close.
That is interesting. She was an apprentice editor back in 2007 on Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Yeah.
And then,
man, I love that movie.
And then this is a dumb connection that doesn't matter, but she was also the assistant editor on one episode of 30 Rock. And Elizabeth Marvel is also on one episode of 30 Rock, though it is not the same episode. So I don't know why I felt the need to bring that up.
That's all right. Well, one thing I do want to mention, and kind of, you know, Brian, you were mentioning some of the comedy of this film, and, you know, I think it's interesting, adding on to what you were mentioning as well, Steve, her character, when they first are introduced to the old man, they turn around and she's doing the same run that Harold does, or is it Harold?
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember. Yeah. It's the same run that Harold does constantly throughout the film, where she's just running away from shit, like just disappearing, like not telling anybody, and just like, you know what? Fuck it, I'm out of here. And I think it's hilarious that they both have that kind of reaction to, you know, things that they don't want to deal with. Harold, in this way, he runs away from this MoMA sequence where they're showing his friend LJ Shapiro, and who is I guess at the time a more celebrated artist, and he's still frustrated by all of this situation, and so he wants to go, Adam Sandler is talking to LJ Shapiro's daughter, and they're having a connection, and his father's like, I gotta go, I'm going now, bye, and just like starts running down the street, and you're just like, what the fuck is going on in this family where they take after each other in so many ways, and yet they, you know, the daughter and Harold didn't really actually have that much of a connection, and yet they have these kind of little things that kind of pull through the entire film. There's another sequence that I really love where Adam Sandler keeps mentioning a joke that Harold mentioned that kind of landed flat with some of the people, and he keeps mentioning it over and over, and Harold never notices. And it's just one of those things where, like, there's just so many little touches like that that are just such a smart little thing. And I bet you a lot of that is probably found in the edit, or, well, I say found in the edit. I mean, obviously that's in the script of dialogue. And I do think Baumbach should get a lot of credit here, because just the ability to have these characters talk over each other, I'm sure gives directors and even the actors themselves nightmares. Stephen, I bet you could probably give us some unique insight into kind of, you know, people talking over each other and what that dialogue ends up kind of, how that takes shape on set.
You mean overlapping dialogue within yes. scenes and how to sort yeah. of orchestrate that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it just starts with casting the people. I mean, what you don't want to see happen is you don't want to cast the wrong people and try to do that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's can go very, very wrong. And it's something that can only come with people who are either well-trained or have profoundly gifted instincts or have been around the block and been doing it for a long time. So there's a certain skill to that. So much of it is about kind of just taking a step back and letting them do their thing. And then somewhere in there, you're going to preserve something really lovely. I mean, what would be torture would be to see all of the scenes that Robert Altman didn't use. Do you know what I'm saying? Like that would be the worst thing that any of us could ever like encounter. It would just be so obnoxious and loud. And, you know, so you're seeing the stuff that's, it's sure. kind of like just gold, you know?
Now that is the only thing I ever want. I would just love that.
Yeah.
That might be a good transition to talk about some of the performances.
Yes, precisely. That's what I was hoping to do. Let's get the big one out of the way first. Adam Sandler is acting in a movie again.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
How do y'all feel about Adam Sandler? I think I am
in general
one of those
in this
people,
movie.
Oh, in general, he's a shit. I'm talking about in his more dramatic stuff, obviously, because I mean, God, I can't watch another Netflix movie with Adam Sandler, except I watched this one and
I
enjoyed this
one. You just did.
So I think. I'm a big fan of him in Punch Drunk Love. I think it's unfortunate that he doesn't get a lot of the roles that I would hope he would get. But at the same time, he's also making a lot of his own shit, and he's doing stuff like just real bad trash. So I don't feel that bad for him at the same time.
Well, I think
I'm not asking anyone to feel bad for him. I mean, you know, he's making a shit ton of money doing what he appears to love, and like, you know,
go on vacation.
Yeah, he's not like someone who really wants to act and like fucked up once and now is like he's doing what he wants to do. Like I have no pity for him, because if he looked at my life, he'd probably be right to pity me. What I'm saying is. I do like when he kind of steps up and does a dramatic role, because I think it's almost informed by all of the other lazier choices that he makes.
Yeah.
Just insofar as like he's tapping into something that he always has, but he's like burying his light under a bushel, but the bushel has really cool shapes cut out in it. So it's casting it in a different way. Like, you know, it's just. It's interesting because even in this movie, you can almost feel like that he was a Happy Gilmore type at one point in his life,
sure.
and is now just kind of been beaten down, and that weird golf swing has given him a hitch in his step.
Yes. That's exactly what I was going to bring up. It's what I find so interesting about his like late dramatic roles. And, you know, even the moments where he shows like shades, like where he's most interesting is when he taps into like this self-loathing. And that's what's so interesting about, you know, whether you consider Punch Drunk Love or, you know, even something like Spanglish or, you know, less so Reign Over Me, or but even like the ending of Click or something, like you see so many different versions of Sandler in this movie in an interesting way. Like, not only that he used to be Happy Gilmore, but, you know, when he's swearing at drivers while trying to park, I mean, you see Happy Gilmore. You could totally hear him, you know, just like curve his voice a little bit when he gets angry and stuff. And so just that he feels like he's not getting what he deserves. It's so bizarre to see him act out like his own feelings of like inadequacy here, because you can just make so many projections on it.
I don't really understand the bad rap, to be honest. And certainly he's made more interesting choices than 90% of other comedians / actors who came out of the SNL scene or came out of the sketch scene. So it's like, if you compare him to, like, I don't know, who are we comparing him to? Al Pacino or like Chevy Chase, right?
I was going to say Jim Belushi, sure. But
yeah, I guess I don't understand this mystery of, you just named a series of good performances of his. And it's also worth saying that the Happy Gilmore days were almost over 20 years ago.
Well, I actually would say that like the Happy Gilmore days and the Billy Madison days were like good days.
Yes.
Yeah. I would say that, like, I don't know, sometime around Grown Ups is when it like public opinion really started to turn, or like when he started producing stuff like Grandma's Boy.
But I actually think, I mean, I think his best performance is Spanglish, to be honest. I mean,
oh,
I love
Spanglish.
Great. I think
we all like Spanglish. Wow.
Yeah, apparently.
He has had, please invite me onto your podcast about Spanglish. No, I think he's as good or better in that than he is in even Punch Drunk or this movie. I think he's really great in that film. And he could have been great in Funny People if that movie had had some sort of like director involved.
It's so weird they released it without a director.
yes, so bizarre. In the first cut, the first assembly, they released it. But I even like, you know, I like some of the stupid stuff. I have a special place in my heart for I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. I do think he's not terrible in Click. So I don't know. I think he's an interesting performer.
People stand up for Click.
I will go to bat for Click.
Yeah, because what I always hear is like, oh, Click, you think it's going to be dumb, but then it's really heartfelt at the end. And I'm like, okay, that's fine.
I think there's something to be said to, you know, comparing him to, sorry, to Chevy Chase, but, you know, you compare something like You Don't Mess with the Zohan, or, you know, even like Grown Ups or The Do-Over, like they are bizarre, bizarre films. Like they're not... you know, some of them are really tough to sit through, but
largely
there's like,
directed by the same guy, by the way,
Dugan.
Dugan.
Yeah, but there's like something fascinating that he brings to some of these films, and they're like misguided in ways you don't expect. Like it's, I don't know. I can't say that I don't regret some of the Netflix Sandler films I've watched, but There's something to them that I think a lot of crap doesn't have.
So are you saying that in a face-off between the Ridiculous Six and Geostorm, which do you think that you would prefer to watch, the Ridiculous Six or Geostorm?
I really like bad disaster movies, though. Like, I'm even a fan of like 2012, Deep Impact.
Wait, whoa! Well, Deep Impact isn't a bad disaster movie.
All right, the Poseidon, or
there you
the
go.
Remake of the Poseidon Adventure with Kurt Russell. That wasn't. I Brian, kind of enjoyed that one.
Brian, when was the last time you saw Deep Impact?
It was like 2 years ago.
What? Jesus.
I was at a friend's house. We were going to go to a bar. We were having like a drink and some pasta before we went out. And then as we were flipping through the television, he was like, what's this? And I was like, oh, it's Deep Impact. He's like, I haven't seen that in forever. And I was like, me neither. And so we were just going to watch it up until the point that we left. Long story short, we got to the bar at midnight because we watched the entirety of Deep Impact.
I'd much prefer Dante's Peak.
Dante's Peak's good.
But like,
that's Brosnan.
You can't put Dante's Peak and Deep Impact against each other. You have to do Dante's Peak and Volcano.
Yeah.
And I guess Impact and Armageddon would go head to head.
Yeah, you're mixing your disasters.
Okay.
Oh man, I want to watch a disaster movie.
In which case, I would say I would go Dante's Peak over Volcano.
Yes.
I don't know about you guys. I expect an answer on this, by the way. Okay. We're not moving on until I get one.
No. I would pick you. I just want to say, I think there is something that Adam Sandler brings to these movies, even at his most, even when he's phoning it in, there's just a bizarre sensibility that he can't really remove. Like, and I don't know how much of that, again, is just, you know, seeing this person who's 20 years past the point when they were, you know, a marquee star. Well, I guess they're still marquee, but you guys know what I'm saying.
Sure.
So it's not necessarily that I'm, you know, would die to watch one of those films or prefer it over something else. I'm just saying that I think it's a little more complicated than a lot of the dismissals that happen.
I'll agree with that. I mean, it's one of those, like, if he has raw talent, it's hard to hide even in a bad movie. You know, he's a person like, you know, chlorine is a poison. But when you bond it with sodium, it becomes table salt. So really, you have to bond the chlorine of Adam Sandler with
isn't Dugan the chlorine?
With the sodium of I guess he's the chlorine. Because Bombac is the sodium, and then he becomes the salt in this delicious dish.
Oh Jesus.
I usually stick to food metaphors. This time I started off in chemistry. Yes. And then worked
you
it
went
into
the
food.
Spices.
Yeah, yes. So I feel like I'm hitting on all cylinders.
I think the Adam Sandler review can come to its conclusion by now. Yeah,
absolutely. I was going to say, I wanted to lay some special praise on Ben Stiller for, I don't know the best way to put this. Like, he's a lot less sad sack, hangdog, like, woe is me shitty in this movie than he usually is, but this is still a character who could be played that way, and so I'm glad that he's finding new variations on a theme.
Well, I really enjoy his character a lot because I can see his character having, like, he kind of spells it out in the film, so I don't think it's this big revelation to mention it. But I mean, you know, he's basically a wildly successful kind of entrepreneur in a lot of ways, and he gets like no respect whatsoever from his father, even though his father constantly looks at everybody else and is like, why aren't you successful? And why aren't you successful? And why am I not as successful as I should be? And, you know, he's got this wildly successful son who's just like, why don't you appreciate like what I've become at all? You know, so I think it's I really enjoy his character's kind of his beats and his background and the way he's kind of performed. And just the fact that, like, even in the middle of his success, he's still his father's son. He still is not able to keep a marriage together, and he still is struggling with how to raise his own child, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's those little things that just kind of all add up. And I really enjoy his character a lot in this film.
I think it's the other thing that makes him a little bit different than some previous Ben Stiller characters is that he's like constantly spinning plates in this movie. Like, there's constantly a sense of where he's being pulled in so many different directions. And I think in him having to react to that, he finds a lot of energy. Or I should say a different energy and being, you know, pulled apart.
I don't really have an opinion about Ben Stiller. I think he does the job he needs to do, and that's about it. Yeah, I mean, that's about all. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that about him. That's about all I have to say. I've always been kind of neutral. He serves projects. He does what needs to be done, and then that's that.
And we've already talked a bit about
Marvel,
yes. and Hoffman. I wanted to take a moment and make sure that we mentioned Emma Thompson as well.
Yes.
What were our thoughts on her?
She is insanity throughout this entire film. Maybe this is too much. I don't know. I have an aunt that she reminds me of a lot. That is just so scatterbrained and has a very direct opinion about a lot of things. And you just want to roll your eye at her. So
that's the thing. I mean, that really gets to the crux of the whole discussion. It's like earlier I was like, it feels like like an SNL parody of a Baumbach movie at certain points. And you're like, oh, there's all these movie stars and they're putting on funny costumes and funny voices. And it's like, what is this really? Right. But then it reminds you of your relative, you know?
Yeah.
So it's still, yes, it's heightened, but also have you been to New York? Have you met the people that these characters are inspired by? You know, I think it's easy to dismiss a lot of this stuff as heightened and caricatured and kind of nutty, you know, but, mm-hmm. you know, let's also take a look at the real world and think about our own relatives.
Coming from working class Queens, I don't have many of these people in my life, but I'm sure that I've seen some of them walking around the village when I'm there.
Yes. But yeah. you've probably seen working class movies that others might say. Caricatured, and you may be like, no, those are actually exactly the kinds of people.
Oh, that's Uncle Benny. What are you talking about?
I don't have an Uncle Benny. Anyway, so but what I wanted.
Everybody's got an Uncle Benny.
One of the scenes that did strike me as like very true to life in the hospital was kind of hit or miss. It was really just like towards the point where they were preparing for him to die. Like everything dealing with nurses and doctors and everything was good. And what really struck me was. When they had to like go and scream at Emma Thompson to like put them on the list of people that the doctors could speak to. Because she's like, what are you? You're like worried that I'm not going to like tell you the truth or something. And it's like, no, we just don't trust you to remember anything. You flighty, flighty drunkard. And it was, but you can't exactly say that because you still need something from that person. And that is
their negotiation with her was really good. You could see them biting their tongue and just being like, no, we trust you completely. It's just we want to help.
Just do it. And yes. That's the type of situation where even though I don't know that person per se, I know people who have that specific problem who you have to have that manner of conversation with. So even if I can't say, oh, Emma Thompson is like my Aunt Reenie or something, I still can say like, oh yeah, I've had to fucking deal with a family member who just like isn't understanding what I'm saying and I'm trying to be nice, but if they don't do what I'm telling them to do soon, I'm gonna bust something out. And so moments like that.
We've also been trained by realism in films we've almost been numb or blinded to real life people's actual ridiculous, heightened, quirky behavior. It's almost like we've seen so much realism in film and TV that we think performances are big when they're actually not, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. There's some recalibration due there.
Hmm.
I think that all happens kind of with growth as you watch films, but also as you live life, the more people you encounter and things like that. And not even just necessarily encounter just briefly, but like actually have meaningful interactions with, and you start to realize like, oh, their quirks are not surface level. It is like, you know, down to the bone. Like that is them. They're not just in a weird mood today. They're in a weird mood all the time, 365. So, yeah.
The last final thing I kind of wanted to talk about was that last section. I wondered whether you guys had any thoughts about how frequent the fade to blacks became. Because, you know, it's kind of throughout the movie, but in that last 10, 15 minutes, it happens about 10 times. And to the point where, Stephen, you already spoke a little bit about the last shot, which we didn't really put in context, but I was unsure whether Eliza was much older and whether, you know, Dustin Hoffman or Harold's character had passed or something. There was, I was a little bit confused about chronology towards the end there. And I just wonder whether you guys, had any thoughts in general about the fade to blacks or that structure editing as a whole, now that we can speak with spoilers about the whole thing.
I know that I liked them without maybe entirely knowing what they were for. It may have had a literal connection to the time that was passing. I felt like it was more an emotional choice, and just in terms of like the, you know, people making decisions, people making smart decisions, people growing up, people getting wiser. There was something about, and also, yeah, I mean, I guess also just life speeding up as you get older too. So I don't know. It was very Arnaud Desplechin, like speaking of like wild, silly filmmakers. Mm. And very kind of Truffaut and like friend. It was like, you know, here we are in a new, life is fast. That's what that stuff said to me. I don't think we jumped too far ahead in time though.
I agree, but I am in agreement with both of y'all. I think it is kind of to show a little bit of the passing of time, but it's also to kind of show how much life just kind of continues to move forward despite what happens. And I think, you know, Baumbach's talked a couple of interviews that I've listened to him about this film. He's talked about like one of the reasons that he made this hospital sequence in particular was because he wanted to deal with the fact that like the family gets together and kind of says their piece to their father under the guise that he's basically not going to make it. And then he makes it and you're just like, what the fuck do I do now? Like I already forgave him and now he's still like poking me in the side every 5 minutes. Like,
yeah, I thought
hell?
I was out of stuff to forgive. I don't have any more forgiveness. I poured it into the corpse that I thought he was, and now he's back.
Yeah. Sandler gets that great line where he's like, I wish he really did something really shitty to me that I could never forgive him for.
So I think that's part of the way that the film towards the end is supposed to kind of almost feel like it's breaking down. I think it's interesting that you mentioned there are 10 fade to black, because I think it's just supposed to be like, hey, life is like really, really moving on here. But in so many ways, it's staying exactly the same for some of these characters, because Adam Sandler's character in particular doesn't have anywhere to go. And so he's just taking care of his father and it's driving him insane. And finally, he just gets enough gumption to just say, you know what, I'm just going to take off for a while. And I'm gonna follow my heart. And I think it's interesting because on the way he of course runs into LJ Shapiro's daughter. And so, you know, he has that little jaunt as well. So I think a lot of that is to just kind of keep the narrative are kind of moving without having to have the structural kind of integrity of like narrative through lines between like cuts. On that, we are already familiar with all these characters. We've already done all of this other kind of groundwork that hopefully, unless you're Michael Snydell, you don't really notice it too much, or you notice it and you understand what's going on.
It's also not new to Baumbach. I mean, I was watching Mistress America today, and speaking of this same editor, Jennifer, what's her last name? Forget.
Lame.
Yeah. I mean, think about the opening sequence of Mistress America, where we're just bam, 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 bam. Like we're establishing massive amounts of locations and character quirks and relationships in the span of like 3 or 4 minutes. There's a speed. if there's anything that he's sort of cornered the market on, it's this like really unusual speed of life, and just especially in terms of just like American cinema, I guess. So, you know, that he's experimenting alongside his editor with editing in a really cool way, I think.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, I say that wraps us up today, talking about the Meyerowitz stories, new and selected. What do we think of that subtitle?
No, terrible.
Like
only on Netflix.
It's the most predictable thing about the entire movie. It's the literary genre he's been working in for 20 years.
Okay. Just like we all forget conveniently that Birdman had a subtitle that was in parentheses as well.
We ache and burn internally.
And I just think that movies, novels, television shows, plays, video games, I know that these are all things that touch upon themselves and kind of intertwine in weird incestuous ways, but you can't, I think that the naming culture should not.
I don't think this is the movie to use to beat that, because this is a movie designed like a novel.
Sure.
In a literary milieu with a literary title. I don't think it's the same as the Birdman subtitle thing.
I don't know. I just don't.
Yeah. It may it may annoy you equally, but I think it's a different category of subtitle.
Yeah, I think it's not. I don't like it, but I kind of think it got me in the mindset for this movie to understand some of the, or you to not understand, but to problem. Try to. to understand some of the structural things and the way that it uses headings and things like that. Just that parentheses in some way prepared me for something a little bit different other than simply a family dramedy.
Here's a question. Would it have made the subtitle better or worse if one of these Meyerowitz clan was a writer?
You mean like a narration?
No, but like if it was the type of thing where like people after the movie could be like, oh, do you think that this is called The Meyerowitz Story is New and Selected because like Jimmy Meyerowitz was a writer and this is, we're watching the book that he wrote about these
people? Oh, fuck no. Fuck no.
He's literally just doing Salinger. I mean, he's doing he's doing Roth, and all those books aren't about authors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, now that I've exercised my demons over the new and selected part of this, let us.
You've got plenty other ones.
I have so many demons I can still hang on to. Let's move on. Let's wrap it up. As always, we are brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. In case you didn't hear it at first, you can get a free 30-day trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage. There's still plenty of time to catch their collection of Takashi Miike films that they are releasing, as well as the cool and spooky movies that they are releasing for Halloween. All you gotta do is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you can understand the wonder that is Mubi. In addition, go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and give us your money so that we can continue to do this wonderful show that all of you enjoy so much. And I know you enjoy it because you tweet at me all the time about it. So do it. Give us your money. Go to patreon.com. I do the soft sell up front, and then I assume anyone who listened to the end will be able to handle me just saying, give us your money. Go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. We appreciate every single one of you, and you will also get access to our Slack channel and our cool raffles. So that is all for today. Gentlemen, Stephen especially, thank you for joining to talk about the Meyerowitz stories, new and selected. Stephen, did you have any other stuff that you wanted to plug before we say goodbye?
No, just go see Princess Sid in New York Museum of the Moving Image starting November 3rd, Gene Siskel Film Center in Chicago starting the same day.
Ooh.
and then the Lamley Music Hall in Los Angeles on December 1st.
Yes. If you are in any of those cities or anywhere close within driving distance, I definitely recommend that you check out that film.
And look for us in December. If you live elsewhere, look for us on VOD very soon.
Excellent. Ooh. All right. Well, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time we talk to them. Stephen, you are our guest, so why don't you kick us off?
Where what am I saying?
like a Twitter or people checking in.
Sorry, yes. No, you mean my like digital soul.
Yeah, don't give us your address or anything. Just...
Okay, yeah. Great. Wow, that was the only time I've been called off guard the entire podcast.
You were doing so well until then.
Twitter handle is Stephen D. Cohn, and I'm around him on all the things.
All right. Michael Snydell.
I'm on Twitter at Snydell, where I'll be fading to black.
Okay. And
oh, Jesus.
Bill Graham.
I'm on Twitter at CableBFG and finishing up Stranger Things. Woo! More Netflix.
Yes. This is Brian J. Rowan. Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. Still haven't watched a single episode of Stranger Things. Don't think that I ever will. You can also find me on personal site, dearfilm.net. You can find most of us on thefilmstage.com. And you can find this podcast on iTunes, where you should definitely give us a comment and a rating. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next week. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no, or a man who makes potions in a traveling show.